Abel brought the sacrificial offering, foreshadowing the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, and Cain was the first Protestant liberal. Cain said, I just need to keep bringing the thank offering. Basically what a lot of people say when they maybe go to church once or twice a year or every Sunday. Thanks for everything that I have, but not, I need to pray that prayer of confession that nothing good dwells in me. I need to hear the absolution that your sins are forgiven for the sake of Christ. On this edition of The White Horse Inn, we're in part two of our series on the Messiah. The White Horse Inn. Know what you believe and why you believe it.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. As you may know, we've been going through the Great Commission. It's been our emphasis this year, 2011. And as we especially come up on Christmas, we thought that it would be a good idea to close out our series on the Messiah in the Old Testament, because actually it's God's mission that is the basis for our mission in the world. And it's God's mission to bring about the fulfillment of his promise in the Garden of Eden to send a Messiah who will crush the serpent's head. And at this stage, we see the beginning of a church founded by the gospel. We already learn in chapter 4 of Genesis what this promise that God made in Genesis 3:15, right on the heels of the fall, produces. It produces a church. The Reformers used to say, the church is the creation of the Word. The Spirit, of course, is the creator of the church, but through the Word. The Spirit uses means, and specifically, it's the gospel. There is no hope for Adam and Eve any more than for the rest of us. And yet, right at the moment of judgment, the sentencing, in the day that you eat from it, you shall surely die, God gives them a promise, a stay of execution. And that stay of execution is basically the rest of the Bible. That space for a church to emerge, for God to bring about his saving purposes and gather a people united to that Messiah, that is the whole purpose of history, actually. So we're going to be talking about this with your usual hosts here, Rod Rosenblatt, professor of theology at Concordia University in Irvine, Kim Riddlebarger, pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California, Ken Jones, who is the pastor of Glendale Baptist Church in Miami, Florida. I'm Mike Horton. I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. After the creation is the fall. Let's unpack that a little bit in the light of how it's interpreted later in the story.
Well, the key thing is the serpent enters the garden, and that raises all kinds of questions about
how to get in.
How to get in. And, yeah. and that prompts the discussion of Adam's failure begins by not casting the serpent from the garden and allowing the serpent to approach his wife and so on. And his questions are, has God really said?
Yeah.
So he's the one who comes and challenges the word and the authority of God.
So it's a courtroom scene.
Yes. Yeah.
And
yes.
You have the prosecutor allowed into the courtroom, the enemy of the great king who has commanded you. Yep. And has not just commanded you, but has lavished you with all of these riches and all of these gifts. You have the enemy of that great king, and you're the viceroy of the great king.
Yep.
You have the enemy of that kingdom received as a diplomat into your kingdom.
And you allow him to impugn the character of the lord of the territory. You allow him to do that.
And that takes place against the backdrop of this blessing-curse principle from which we get our covenant of works and covenant of grace, and the Lutherans derive law and gospel, as do we from that basic premise. God has already told Adam, look, the day in which you eat of this tree, you will surely die. And so we flip that around and make a positive statement, do this and live. So Adam already knows what's required of him. This is not a secret.
And
this
he
is
knows
not a
it
mystery.
Well.
And he knows
better
it well.
Better than we ever will.
It's very clear.
Yeah.
And he had absolutely no propensity to fall.
No, and he had the ability, as created in God's image, to obey.
Yeah. This is a point, by the way, where we disagree with Augustine. and, frankly, the Roman Catholic tradition that came from Augustine that basically says you need a grace before the fall in order to sustain Adam so that he could fulfill his trial, because basically he was ranged because of his composite nature between heaven and earth. His higher self, his soul and mind,
and love and virtue
were oriented toward God and the angels. But in his earthly respect, he was like the animals. So he could either look up, Augustine said, and be like the angels, or look down and be like the beasts. And he allowed his bodily appetites to drag him down. Calvin has a whole section on how pernicious this idea is. First of all, I think Calvin rightly says, God then is the author of evil.
Yeah.
God
yeah.
made Adam
yeah.
fall,
right.
because if you kick away that grace, and that's...
Donum super additum.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's the Augustinian yeah. view, that God took away that grace, that sustaining grace. Well, yeah, if I were on the next to last rung of the ladder, almost to the top of the roof, and you kicked the ladder out from underneath me, I'd probably fall too.
Mm-hmm.
We don't believe that. We believe that he was created in true righteousness and holiness,
yep.
totally capable of completing everything God had given him to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that model has to be understood later when we see the law given to man in our fallen condition. You say, well, but we are fallen. We can't keep it. The issue is Adam could
yeah.
before
yeah.
the fall.
Yeah, I think it's important we teach our parishioners there have been a total of three humans with free will toward things heavenly.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And only three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Adam, Eve, and Jesus.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's the total list.
yeah. In fact, in our confession, we confess that Adam fell by his own free will.
Yeah.
Yes. People might be surprised that Calvinists confess that, but that's
right.
that is standard Reformed
exactly.
as well as Lutheran teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. You know, instead of listening to every word that comes from the mouth of God, Adam and Eve sought autonomy. You think of the way Eve is reasoning mm-hmm. with the serpent. You know, she's already breaking away from every word that comes from the mouth of God. You know, I don't understand everything, but I'm not God. There's no reason I shouldn't know that, because
right.
I'm a rational person.
And yeah. she even adds to what he says.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She
yeah.
adds
to the command. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. He said, not only should we not eat it, but even touch it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. You know, Luther starts talking about the fall having occurred before they ate of the fruit.
Yeah.
And
oh,
he's talking
yeah.
about this.
Yeah. Right.
He's
yeah.
talking about what's going on inside and the lack
yeah.
of fear, love, and trust in the one who created them.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we go back even a little farther with Adam allowing the serpent to enter the garden in the first
yeah.
place.
Mm. Because his job was, as Israel's was, to cleanse
yeah.
the garden
yes.
of
prepare
the
it.
Enemy of the Lord. That's the reason for the holy wars in Israel.
Yep.
I mean, we're getting
yep.
ahead of the story now. But really, Israel was called to do the same thing as Adam.
Hmm.
High priests, prophets, and kings meant to drive the serpent out, but instead they succumbed to the voice of the idolaters around them and fell.
And died.
And died in the wilderness. And that's why Hosea 6:7 says, like Adam, Israel broke the covenant.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Other parallels, you have the failure to cleanse the temple and land. Adam and Eve are sort of grumbling against their creator. This was a no-no in the ancient Near Eastern political scene. One of the things in the ancient Near Eastern treaties was, there will be no grumbling.
Mm.
and, you will like it.
And this did
do
not,
it and like it.
This did not mean what my children do yeah. when I tell them that we're not stopping so they can use the restroom on a trip.
or empty the jar.
Yeah, did I say that out loud?
I'd hope you said stop so they could have a hamburger.
Yeah, a social worker is probably going to visit my house, but my dad didn't let me and I won't let them. This grumbling is a political term, and it meant basically people smiling at the king, bringing their tithe or tribute yeah. offering to the king, but then behind his back, meeting even with his enemies and saying, well, yeah, no, he doesn't really. And the enemy says, he doesn't really take care of you, does he?
Mm.
Like, well, yeah, you know, you have a point about this. I don't agree with you on that, but yeah. And then, so the grumbling is basically a stage on the way to treason.
Hmm.
Just, you have that in the Garden of Eden, and then you have it in the wilderness where
yeah.
grumbling, you know, places are called grumbling.
Yeah.
Because that's the place where Israel grumbled against
Meribah.
The Lord. Meribah, this is a lawsuit. This is actually, again, a legal political term that means bringing a lawsuit against God.
Mm.
You are holding us down.
Yeah.
We're being oppressed. We're being repressed. You know, it's time for us to be liberated. You know, it's time for us to get out from under the thumb of this God who wants to tell us what to do. And
he won't let us eat from any tree.
Yeah.
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 No.
No.
He didn't say any tree. He said all the trees except this one.
Yeah.
And then you have Jesus appear. And in Matthew 4, he is taken by the Spirit out into the wilderness. And he is recapitulating the 6 days labor, seventh day rest. And you have Adam and Eve in the temptation, succumbing, instead of listening to every word that comes from God's mouth, succumbing to temptation. You have Israel grumbling, and instead of listening to the word and believing the promise, they grumbled and complained. Here, Jesus, the last Adam, and the true Israel, is taken into the wilderness by the Spirit of God, and Israel's 40 years are reduced down to 40 days.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus says, quoting the scriptures, it's not just that he says, well, you've just got to believe the Bible. He practices what he preaches. He quotes, God himself incarnate quotes passages from the Old Testament and says, this is the way it looks for a creature to have a covenantal relationship with God. Yeah. You will not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of the mouth of God.
Yeah. This is the second Adam doing what the first Adam failed to do.
Yep.
Lifting up the character of God through God's own words.
Looking the serpent in the face and saying, get out of my garden.
Yes.
And the twisted way that the serpent tempted was using Scripture itself.
Yes.
This was a contest.
Yes, exactly.
Which he did in the garden, too.
He does it in the garden.
Who understands the sense of the Scriptures and who doesn't.
Yeah, the devil understands more scripture than a lot of Christians. He twists it, distorts it just a little here and a little there. And then just as Adam and Eve are exiled from the land in Genesis 3, Israel is exiled from the land and barred from the tree of life. But that's actually a good thing, because if they would have eaten from the tree of life, they would have been confirmed in everlasting death, and every one of us would be continuing to be born into the world with absolutely no hope. God couldn't have proclaimed the gospel because we would have been immortalized as the damned. Gratefully, God said, no, you can't get back to the tree of life, but here's what I'm doing. I'm going to announce a gospel, and I'm going to keep that tree of life barred, locked up, and then when the one who comes fulfills what I'm promising, you're going to eat the tree of life and live forever.
Amen.
After Genesis 4 comes the story of Noah, and of course in Genesis 6 especially, you get the great promise that Noah and his family are going to be saved, and while the whole world is laughing at the guy because he believes that this judgment is going to come upon the whole earth and destroy every living thing, he starts out the task of building that ark. And we get the details in Genesis 6 of Noah, the length, and bring all the animals and so on. He and his family enter the ark, and then the flood comes, and so God's judgment comes upon the whole world, and Noah and his family are saved in this ark. So you get this, again, being called out, being rescued.
Remnant.
The ordeal of judgment coming upon the whole world, consuming them, interesting enough, by water. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, we'll figure in later on to some of the sacramental theology that
Peter
comes,
picks up on.
Yeah, and Peter picks up on 1 Peter chapter 3. So Noah and the flood mark a real turning point in redemptive history, in that God wipes off the face of the earth.
Yeah, well, one thing about Noah, because a lot of times when you hear Noah mentioned, it's because he's introduced as being a perfect man in his generation, But the verse that precedes that statement, I think it's verse 8 where it says, "And Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." Mm-hmm. It's God's grace that precipitates everything else that we
absolutely.
Will read.
As Hebrews 11.
Yeah, he's justified by faith.
Yes, yeah. And that's so critical because what people will lift up is Noah being perfect in his generation as if he were, you know, somehow sinless, and that's why he found favor. But it's actually, it begins with Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord.
And he did what God told him to do.
Yeah, God spoke to me.
That's not
God
why he was
word.
Justified, but he is righteous in the sense that he's, first of all, justified, but also can be called righteous compared to all of his compadres out there, because unlike Adam, he did do what God told him. But again, look at what happens afterwards, where he messes everything up.
Yep.
He does horrible things that would really disqualify any minister from the ministry today.
Yeah.
It's tragic, and yet he's still justified. He's still righteous in God's sight, and it just goes to underscore again that none of these great figures in the history of redemption is the Messiah. They're all pointing forward to the one that they're looking to save them.
Well, you get the same thing with Lot, especially. You know, Lot is just this checkered character and seems like he's doing some things good and then all of a sudden he messes up. But then when we meet him again in the New Testament, Peter calls him Righteous Lot.
Well, and then, of course, key moment in redemptive history is when God gives the sign of the rainbow at the end of the flood account. And the idea there, of course, is that the bow pointing to the heavens is a reminder that God will take the curse away through some means as yet unrevealed. We know that later to be the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And then God reestablishes the common grace covenant by saying that I'm not going to do this again to the whole earth. I'm not going to destroy the world by flood again.
And it's interesting, in the book of Revelation, you have judgment that is cataclysmic, you know, the mother of all judgments, very similar in many respects to the judgment of the city of man in Noah's day. And then it all ends with peace and everlasting righteousness and the Lord in his Sabbath enthronement having rest from all enemies. There is no more war. And what appears behind the throne? A rainbow.
A rainbow,
In many ways, the book of Revelation just cannot be understood without the Old Testament. As you said, Kim, you can't read the Bible, the book of Revelation in one hand and the newspaper in the other. You need to read the book of Revelation in one hand and the Old Testament
exactly.
in the other.
Yeah. If no more than Genesis.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's one of those I think, classic cases that if we had been Jews living in the first century when John was given that vision that we now know as the book of Revelation, and we were familiar with the Torah and knew that as well as most Jews of that age did, we would not have to question any of those symbols in the book of Revelation. We would know exactly that these are drawn directly from the Old Testament and set against the backdrop of the Roman Empire. So Revelation is not some weird, mysterious book. It's actually a commentary on all these themes we're talking about that appear throughout redemptive history.
How about Genesis 14, where you have that strange figure Melchizedek appear out of the shadows? And it's not as if he becomes all that clear later in redemptive history.
Hebrews 7, he's a priest of Salem. Salem is probably the ancient location of Jerusalem.
Also the king, Melech, he's the king of Salem.
So he, strangely enough, occupies two offices that were not held by anybody together in Israel. A priest and a king.
But he's also called the priest of the Most High God.
Priest of Yahweh, which is really remarkable.
Yeah.
So where's he come from? He's not part of the covenant line. He you know, he appears on the scene just kind of out of the blue.
But he's a high priest in the church.
And Abraham, who's already been described as the man of faith, stops after he gets his cattle and stuff back from the raider, and he gives tribute out of those captured goods to Melchizedek.
Mm-hmm.
The pagan kings want the people for themselves to turn into slaves, but Abraham says, no, I'm going to give the booty,
the tribute
to Melchizedek. And that's just a very odd.
And anybody, again, who knew anything about the politics of that time and place would have known what that means. It was a political act basically saying, I am your serf.
I am
your vassal.
Yeah.
You are the great king. He was basically signing a treaty with right. Melchizedek, whoever this fellow was, signing a treaty with him saying, you're my Lord, and no one but God was Abraham's Lord. So whoever this is, he's that significant. And then he blesses. This is the
exactly.
language.
Yeah.
He blesses Abram with bread and wine. Interesting. Blesses him with bread and wine. And all of this suggests, even without the passages that come later in the biblical story, that this is God, maybe a Christophany, an appearance of Christ before his incarnation, or at the very least, a figure who very typologically points to the coming Messiah.
Right, who certainly had been given special revelation apart from Abraham's special revelation. That's for sure. Right.
And the interesting thing there is Abram has shown almost his family has almost become like this military troop. He delivers his nephew from a precarious situation and is the hero for two nations, Sodom and Gomorrah. He's a hero, and yet he is brought to this king, who is actually a king as well as a high priest. And it's almost to say, well, Abram, you know, yeah, God was with you in delivering you from the hands of your enemies. But there is the king. There is this king that he has to bow to.
Well, in Psalm 110, when he's mentioned again, David seems to say that whoever is going to be the king of Israel is also going to somehow be connected to Melchizedek. It's not really defined.
Right.
And then in Hebrews, the whole case for Christ's eternal priesthood stems from the fact that Jesus was not a descendant from Aaron.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He's from the tribe of Judah. Mm-hmm. So how on earth can Jesus be the high priest if he's not connected to the Aaronic priesthood? Well, that's because he's a priest after the order of Melchizedek.
See, that's the thing. How can you part and the Jews were absolutely right.
Sure.
How it's a very good question. How can you have a restoration of temple and throne unless the promise that the Messiah would be a lineal descendant of David and high priest, which meant from the order of Aaron? How on earth, those are two different lines.
Yeah.
How could those converge in one person? And as you say, Hebrews is saying, basically he's offering a legal argument for the Messiah. He is both priest and king because he got his legal papers for his priesthood not from the Aaronic line, which could only issue in a temporal, physical, earthly temple.
A sinful priest who had to make offerings for himself.
But an everlasting priesthood that is in line with the Melchizedek priesthood.
The Aaronic priesthood is established according to the Mosaic law, and Melchizedek is in that office before the giving of the law.
Yeah.
And this isn't based on the priesthood that was established by the law at Mount Sinai.
Right.
Here's the passage you were quoting from Psalm 110. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. So there's one verse quoted many, probably.
I think that's the most quoted verse of the Old Testament in the New.
I think so too. And then verse 4, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind.
Yep.
You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And then, as you say, Hebrews picks at it. Whoever Melchizedek is, he is no ordinary person and may well be a Christophany.
Yeah. Well, and I do think, though, because I've heard people make the argument for Christophany, and of course, I think there would be some difficulties there. One, that would be the only Christophany where Christ actually occupies an earthly office prior to his incarnation. He's actually priest and king before Abram encounters him. But I think perhaps what's being displayed there is what confirmed a priest and a king, and we see this even in the Old Testament, is genealogy. That's what you get in Chronicles, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. That's what you get in 1st and 2nd Kings. So you don't have a genealogy for Melchizedek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nobody knows where he comes from or
exactly.
who he is.
So it has the appearance of eternality because there's no, and you also get in the Chronicles as well as in 1st and 2nd Kings, the beginning and the end of their reign. Mm-hmm. He's the son of so-and-so, he lives so long,
and he
dies here. You don't get any of that, but yet he's confirmed in both of those offices.
And that's an important point to make about all of the genealogy sections in Genesis and then throughout the rest of the Bible. We like to skip over those verses because we say, what
right.
on earth?
Yes.
Who would put, for example, in an evangelistic tract,
so-and-so begat
so-and-so. So-and-so begat so-and-so. The point there is, and this is why it's dangerous to judge how much time elapsed by the genealogies.
Yeah.
They leave so many people out. You don't know how many generations have passed. It's selective. They're skipping over people. Why? The point to be made is this Ancestry.com thing going on here in the Bible underscores the point that the whole thing is about Jesus. The
right.
whole thing is about the Messiah and the Messianic
exactly.
line. The reason so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat, so-and-so is so important. And the Gospel of Matthew starts with...
That was the next thing we're going to mention. If you look at the earthly ministry of Christ, you get this genealogy, which is reminiscent of the Old Testament genealogies, affirming his right and his claim mm-hmm. to who he is.
Because if it doesn't go back to the right figures, and it has nothing to do with their morality.
Yes.
No,
has
no.
Absolutely. That's
yes.
why I love Matthew's genealogy is so fascinating, because there are a lot of rascals in there.
Scoundrels in there. Yeah, exactly.
Rahab, the harlot.
It is, it is all right back to the promise that we'll encounter later in 2 Samuel 7. That I'm going to have, I know you and your heirs, David, are going to be mess ups.
Yeah.
My promise is that your son will sit on the throne forever.
Yes.
I will make sure that you'll have an everlasting throne no matter what your sons do. And he fulfilled that. That's the point of the genealogies. The
right.
point is, I'm going to get this done.
Right.
In spite of you all.
Well, after the account of Melchizedek in Genesis 14, you come to Genesis 15, and that's the account of God establishing the first stage in God establishing this covenant of grace with Abraham. Because back in Genesis chapter 12, God has called Abraham out of Ur, out of the land of the Chaldees, and promised him that he would be a father of many nations and that that nation would become a great nation. Then in Genesis 15, God appears to Abraham, and we have this remarkable sense in which still Abram, not Abraham yet,
right?
Still Abram, he falls into the deep sleep, and he has a vision of severed animal halves. And he sees a torch and a fire pot going through the severed animal halves. And we read that and think, what on earth is that all about? Well, again, back to the ancient treaty rituals. This was a sign when the great king would have his vassal witness the severing of animals. This is going to happen to you if you do not obey the covenant. This is serious business.
Mm-hmm.
So the smoking fire pot and the torch.
And I'm going to make you walk through the pieces before witnesses
exactly.
to seal the deal.
So Abraham's familiar with this. This is not foreign to him. It's foreign to us, but not to him.
God is saying, I'm entering into a covenant with you. I'm
right.
walking through the pieces
yep.
alone.
Hmm.
And that was very strange. There's no example that people know of, scholars know of an ancient treaty, political treaty, where the great king is the one
who walks through the halves.
Who walks through the halves, because that would be totally undignified. That's the wrong relationship.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, you are my servant.
Mm-hmm.
But no, here the lord of the treaty is the one who says, I'm the only one. He doesn't even take Abraham with him.
Yeah.
I'm the only one who must die if this treaty is broken.
Yeah, he's guaranteeing the terms of the covenant.
Wow. It's all on my side.
Yeah.
And then followed in Genesis 17 with the ratification of the covenant with this weird thing called circumcision.
Hmm.
And why that? Well, what's symbolized by circumcision is the removal of the foreskin, the bigger picture being those who are outside the covenant are not going to reproduce. Their line is cut off from the covenant. I mean, what captures that being cut off mm-hmm. from the line any clearer than that? It also is the shedding of blood. And so we're given this picture that those who are God's people are going to be redeemed by the shedding of blood. Hence, they bear in their bodies the sign and seal of that, the removal of the skin and the shedding of blood. So that mm-hmm. makes perfect sense in light of that context as well.
And don't we miss the point of circumcision when we... Again, allegorize it, spiritualize it, turn it into something about me and my personal experience, when really the point of circumcision, as you say, well, first, circumcision, it points forward to the circumcision of the heart.
Right.
And of Christ in Colossians 2.
And of Christ, his circumcision death.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
those who are circumcised are partially cut off. A piece of them is cut off so that the whole person can be saved from being cut off. Whereas Christ, Colossians says, was wholly cut off, like Isaac would have been if the angel hadn't spared him. He had the knife plunged into his breast and broke his heart. That total cutting off is what Jesus underwent, but all that those who are united to him have to undergo is this partial cutting off of the flesh, but mainly because it pointed forward to him. And you talk about human beings needing a very clear sacrament.
It doesn't get clearer than that.
It doesn't get clearer than that, and it's really about reproduction. Again, going back to the genealogies.
Hmm.
God is obsessed with ancestry in Scripture because it leads to the Messiah, that seed who would crush the serpent's head.
And I don't want to sound irreverent, but this is why the New Covenant's a better covenant.
Hmm.
It's a lot easier to convert. You know, there are things in the Old Covenant that are really difficult.
Yeah.
There are things that are bloody. They're just for example, if you were in an Old Covenant kind of community, there would be lots of animals being killed.
Sure.
Right.
There would be priests that did things in secret, and you would spend your entire life wondering, what goes on in there?
Yes.
What happens in that place?
Yes.
Or even go back to Moses, where, you know, Moses himself was married to a non-Israelite. She was a Midianite. And you could tell that she was sort of in catechism class, but wasn't quite there yet. she didn't quite get the whole business. What she did know is that Moses, probably out of deference to her, did not want to have the child baptized. Circumcised.
Brother Jones is having a fit over here.
I'm listening.
And by the way, I mean, this you can take as an example. It's dangerous to marry a non-Christian.
Oh, absolutely.
And someone outside the covenant community. But one thing she knows, God was angry and was going to kill her husband. That's what the text says.
Yeah.
God was looking for Moses to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
This is serious business. If you don't circumcise your children, they will be cut off. And now Moses is about to be cut off. God is looking around for Moses. With knife in hand, and if you don't circumcise that boy, I'm going to circumcise you.
Well, and there's that incident later on as Israel's about to enter to land of Canaan, that they've been wandering the wilderness for 40 years, no one was circumcised.
Right.
And so you can have a mass circumcision before they cross the Jordan and enter Canaan. You can just
better to do it as a...
I forget how long the time is, but it's a significant amount of days, because obviously the soldiers weren't exactly up for combat.
But what's interesting there with Moses is Zipporah takes matters into her own hands.
Right.
She takes the knife.
Right.
She circumcises the son, and then she picks up the foreskin that she's just cut off her son and throws it at Moses' feet and says, "Your God is a bloody God, and this is a bloody religion."
Yeah.
And she's right.
She's right. And this goes all the way back to Cain and Abel. This is a bloody religion. And if you don't get that right, that there is no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood. If you don't get that right, and you want to be like Cain and just, you care enough to send the very best and send God flowers, God is not going to be pleased with that. God needs a sacrificial offering to propitiate his wrath.
And again, all of that is pointing forward so that we have a better context to understand the crucifixion of Christ.
And that's, when we say a better covenant, we ain't kidding. The benefits are great in the new covenant.
And God will cut anybody off, even if they're a minister. Even if they are a zealous Bible-believing Christian. God will come with the knife and cut anybody off out of the covenant community if they bring their works, the fruit of their labors, and not a sacrifice, namely faith in Jesus Christ. And it's not even our faith that is that sacrifice. It's Christ who is that sacrifice. The history of the patriarchs, that is the fathers of Israel, unfolds then in Genesis 16. let's walk through that a little bit.
Isaac and Ishmael, the two sons. Which one's born first?
Yeah.
And he had every right and title to the covenant because he was the firstborn son.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yet God will have mercy on whom he will have mercy, and he'll have compassion on whom he'll have compassion.
Well, and that whole scenario is, it goes back to something that we said before, in following this model and an approach to the scriptures, we have to follow the model that's established in the New Testament. This scenario is really set forth for us in the clearest terms by Paul in Galatians.
Mm-hmm.
If we ever lose sight of that, you know, you think, well, this is just you guys.
Major,
you know,
argument.
Yeah. Paul goes back and he not only mentions Isaac and Ishmael, but he also uses Sarah and Hagar, two mountains as well.
Yep.
And he uses the language of two covenants.
Yep.
He goes to Sinai and Zion, and he says that the Zion of God is not the Jerusalem here on earth, but is a heavenly Jerusalem. And he makes the case for us that everything that we're saying about things pointing to Christ as the interpretive grid by which we are to understand the unfolding of redemptive history, the argument is made for us right here in Galatians 4.
In fact, it's really weird. Paul says some very incendiary things that any Jew of the period would have taken as such when he says, and you know, the earthly Jerusalem is in bondage and therefore is the child of Hagar.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are fighting words.
Yep.
And of course, the Arabs are the children of Hagar. We're the children of Sarah. You got it backwards, Paul.
Yeah.
No, actually, spiritually speaking, you're the heirs of Hagar now.
Right.
Yep.
And by the way, your mountain is in Arabia.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mount Sinai, the mountain of the law, is in Arabia. We worship in heaven.
Right.
The heavenly Jerusalem with Christ as our mediator.
And Sarah is our mother.
And Sarah is our mother.
Yes. That's right.
And she is the free woman.
Yes. Isn't
that amazing?
Yeah.
It's an amazing passage.
And it's in detail.
Yeah.
Well, again, this is why we as Christians have to allow the New Testament to interpret these Old Testament narratives.
Yeah. Because we don't just come to the Bible clean slate. As Christians, we come to the Bible with certain convictions. You don't read through Genesis and have character studies and then all of a sudden becomes about Christ later down the line when you get to Galatians.
That's a great point.
No,
you go to Genesis with the understanding of these events as it's presented to you in Galatians.
Great point.
Yep.
As Paul interprets it in Romans 9, you have here, in this patriarchal history with Ishmael and Isaac, Jacob and Esau, God's prerogative, once again, God saving through a remnant. Again, you have this whole history of things going terribly wrong, and instead of just wiping the human race out as he could have, he narrows it down to a remnant and saves the whole world through Noah, saves the whole nation through Judah. He always saves through a remnant. And he has this prerogative to choose Isaac and not Ishmael. He has this prerogative to choose Jacob and not Esau. And Paul says, even though the twins were not yet born and had done nothing,
either good or bad,
so that it would be according to God's electing purpose, not according to works.
Yeah.
Yep.
How much clearer than that can you get?
Yeah.
You have to interpret the Old Testament in the light of the New, and that's what's going on here in these passages. But then you get to Genesis 22 and the sacrifice of Isaac.
Mm.
Again, wow. If you ever needed the New Testament to interpret the Old, here's one great example.
Yeah, this one and the slaughter of the Canaanites are two that you have to have New Testament help with, or you're going to really, really stumble.
Yep.
What happens here, and why is it significant in redemptive history?
Well, the famous story here is that God commands Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, and read between the lines and see the struggle that's going on internally in Abraham as he's, you want me to do what?
Yeah.
And Abraham does it. He takes Isaac up the mountain.
Yep.
And Isaac, of course, is not a small child. This is a man.
He's a young adult.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, just at the moment where he's about to cut his throat or do whatever it is that was required, he sees a ram caught in the thicket. And so the Lord intervenes, prevents Abraham.
The angel keeps him.
And then the ram instead is sacrificed. So it's just
Substitutionary atonement.
It's substitutionary atonement. Mm-hmm. It shows us, A, how seriously God takes sin.
Isaac should have died.
That sacrifice is required for God's wrath to be turned aside. It shows us again that why Abraham's called a man of faith. He believes in promises unseen.
Yeah, Hebrews explains that by saying, in you know, when Abraham offered up Isaac, believing in the resurrection.
Yes. Believing in the resurrection. Yeah. Yes. God could give him back.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And then God providing the substitute.
And trusting that God would keep his promise. He knew what God had promised him. And so in his thinking, the only way, if he wants me to do this, the only way he's going to keep his promise is to bring this young man back.
Yeah. Sarah, I don't think Sarah figures prominently in that part of the narrative. And you could imagine, I don't know where she is at this point. Abram himself has gone from wavering back and forth, will I really believe the promise? Now he really believes the promise, partly because God has given the evidence for it. Yeah. He's given him this son.
The son.
But you could imagine Sarah wondering, and again, I'm not saying she did, but you could imagine her wondering in her tents, what on earth is God doing now?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. I wavered. Yes, I laughed when it was announced to me that I would be the mother of the messianic seed. I laughed.
Yes.
And now I believe. But now God has commanded my husband to take.
To kill him.
It wasn't just something we could draw an analogy to in our own experience. What would it be like if God asked you to sacrifice your son?
No.
This is sacrificing the promised son.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
Why would God cut off that promise of salvation for the world? All in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed.
Yep.
Why would he basically say the world can't be saved?
And that son, remember,
what's happening?
Remember that son was the product of an old man who was not able to bear children anymore. Right. Sarah's womb was dead. Well, that's the son that's ordered.
Well, the other thing is, and this is what Kierkegaard does so much with, is the contradiction between the promise and then the command to kill him.
Yeah.
And boy, he drags us out and out and out. And it's, what do you mean? This is the covenant. This is, I mean, remember all those promises?
Yeah.
And I'm going to put a knife in it?
Right. Yeah.
So God has to raise him from the dead. That's the only possible explanation.
Well, you know, I've heard guys who talk about him leaving the others who came with him to go up the mountain with Isaac.
Yeah.
And one of the things he says is,
we'll be back.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
We
will
shall
be back.
Return. Yeah.
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 We
yeah.
will be back.
Never thought about that. That is interesting. Here's how Peter interprets that, and then we will return to talk about the rest of this on the next program. Peter says, and you call on him as Father, who judges impartially according to each one's deeds. Conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in these last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God.
Amen.
Wow.
Look forward to being with you again next time on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorsein.org.